Hello, I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton.
And this is Your Health. This week, an old-fashioned disease returns on the wings of some very modern circumstances.
And one man's battle of life and death, with the germs taking over his swimming pool.
And a story about the controversial therapy that promises to turn gay people into straight people.
And we'll check in with our favorite health blogger, Scott Hensley, about what's been on his plate this week.
But first, it was another rough week on the food safety front. Millions of pounds of ground turkey were pulled off of store shelves in one of the biggest recalls ever.
That's because a strain of Salmonella, known to be resistant to multiple antibiotics, was found at one Arkansas processing plant.
Bacteria like Salmonella become resistant to antibiotics when they've been exposed to them a lot at low levels. And as Allison Aubrey reports, any bacteria on a modern farmyard has plenty of opportunity to sample a whole cocktail of antibiotics.
Farmers who raise livestock and poultry dispense nearly 30 million pounds of antibiotics each year. That's a heck of a lot more than doctors prescribe to people, nearly four times as much. So why are farm-raised animals given so much medicine?
Animals are given antibiotics for a number of reasons, including to get them to grow faster.
To get them to grow faster? So it has nothing to do with fighting infection?
Right. These are given to perfectly healthy animals to get them to grow faster, to convert their food more efficiently so that they get to market faster.
Gail Hansen is a veterinarian and a public health expert. She works for the Pew Campaign on Human Health and Industrial Farming. She says in instances of bacterial infection, antibiotics are clearly effective for livestock and farm animals. But the current practice of routinely adding low doses of antibiotics to animal feed, she says, is creating a problem. The bacteria that cause disease are becoming resistant to antibiotics.
When we give antibiotics to animals to get them to grow, we're giving them at very low doses. And that's how you set up bacteria becoming resistant to the antibiotic. There's not enough antibiotic to kill off the organism, enough to prime the pump, so to speak, so that the bacteria learns how to become resistant to the antibiotic that's being used.
And this could become a problem for us. Hansen says the very strain of Salmonella, called Heidelberg, which has made people sick in this outbreak and led to the recall of ground turkey meat, is resistant to three different antibiotics.
One of them is ampicillin, one of them is streptomycin, and one of them is tetracycline. All of those are antibiotics that a physician would likely take off the shelf to treat for disease. None of those three will work.
There are still alternatives that doctors can use, but it's an example of the problem. Antibiotic resistance didn't arise all of a sudden. For years, critics have been pushing for reform. There are two big government agencies involved. The Food and Drug Administration has the authority to regulate the use of antibiotics in farm animals, and they have developed a guidance policy. It's still in draft form. It basically says that using antibiotics to get healthy animals to grow faster should not be done. And this past May, the watchdog group Center for Science and the Public Interest petitioned the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which regulates food products. Currently, Salmonella is not considered an adulterant in food, which means contaminated products can't be recalled until they actually cause illness. And CSPI's Caroline Smith-DeWall says that's crazy. She says the agency needs to classify Heidelberg and three other antibiotic-resistant strains of Salmonella as adulterants.
This means that the industry and the government would engage in more testing, and hopefully it would result in earlier recalls before there are outbreaks, or certainly earlier in the outbreak.
The ground turkey recall is one of the largest in history, and the National Turkey Federation says they'll keep working with federal agencies on antibiotic use and food testing. But Sherry Rosenblatt, who's vice president of the federation, says people should understand that antibiotic use is necessary.
Antibiotics is a great way for the industry to ensure that the food supply is the highest quality, most nutritious, safest, and most affordable in the world.
She says one strategy to prevent antibiotic resistance is to have animals and people taking different antibiotics. As for the voluntary ground turkey recall, Cargill says it has already identified enhancements to its procedures to ensure safe food. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
We We're joined now by Scott Hensley. You all know Scott. He runs SHOTS. It's our health blog. It's really great. What's been the human health impact of these infected turkeys?
The recall that was announced this week affected 36 million pounds of ground turkey, million, spanning February to August. So this stuff has been in people's refrigerators, they've eaten it, and as far as the CDC knows right now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, at least 70 some odd people have gotten sick, and one person has died as a result, and they're still investigating, and it's likely that more cases will crop up now that they know what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the biggest recalls in U.S. history, right?
I would take your word for it. I think that's right. Yeah, it's big. It's really big. I mean, I wondered how many turkeys that would be. It's got to be a lot.
Well, and when you say it's one of the biggest recalls, do you mean in terms of just amount of food?
Uh-huh. It was both the amount of food that's covered and also where it was sold. I mean, this was all across the country. Some of the hotspot states were in the upper Midwest and then out west, but really it's across the country because this plant, part of Cargill, was a supplier to chains, grocery store chains, and supplied food to all sorts of places.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering, I mean, I, for example, have some ground turkey in my freezer. Now, I don't have the original packaging because I broke it out of the packaging and wrapped it up in foil, and so I don't really know if this is tainted or not. Should I just throw it away?
Yes.
Would you?
I would. I mean, you know, if you do know what number it is, you can take it back to the store and get your money refunded. But if you don't really know and you're not really sure, I would just throw it out.
The Department of Agriculture reminded people in the context of this recall that poultry, like ground turkey, should be cooked to at least 165 degrees Fahrenheit. So that should be enough to kill any salmonella that might be in there. It's a good reminder, make sure the food is properly cooked and make sure that, especially with poultry, you're keeping your cutting boards separate for the different parts of the food that you're going to be making for dinner
and
or lunch or
whatever. And your knives
and
utensils
and exactly. Keep your
dish
hands
towels
clean.
And keep your hands clean, yeah.
Do you know what the USDA says? Now, I want to ask you, when you wash your hands in the kitchen, how long do you wash your hands?
Oh, well, you say the alphabet.
Oh,
everybody
really?
Knows that.
Everybody knows that?
And you do that every time, Rebecca?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try that. 20 seconds before and after handling poultry, the USDA says.
Huh.
20 seconds.
20 seconds.
Let's see. A, B, C, D, E, F.
I get the idea already.
Okay, okay.
Come on.
H, I, J, K. I'm going to see if it goes to 20 seconds. Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X. I've got 10 more seconds. Scott.
Yes.
What else have you been covering this week?
Well, a little bit of time spent exercising can help you more than you might think. So we have a
Woo-hoo.
Post. Yeah, we have a post on how much exercise do you actually have to do to get a benefit. A crackerjack epidemiology student at the Harvard School of Public Health was looking over the literature and realized it was pretty hard to tell exactly how much exercise would really get you a benefit. And while it's true, the more aerobic or moderate exercise you get, the more benefit you get, he says even a little bit counts. And in looking at the most relevant studies, even 15 minutes a day could be enough to really get you some benefit. So,
and how much benefit? Wasn't all that much benefit, was it?
What he pointed out was that just getting up off the couch and doing regular exercise is going to give you a lot of the benefit. And if you exercise like a demon, you get relatively less benefit for those demonic extra minutes that you do.
Yes, so, I know them
so,
well.
So get going, do something. It won't hurt you and it could help you. Yeah. And it was a nice reminder.
Yeah.
It might be encouraging too, I think, to people, because sometimes if you think about all the things we're supposed to be doing to stay healthy, to eat the proper foods and exercise 30 minutes a day, it's kind of interesting to see something that even a tiny bit of effort, 15 minutes a day, that's like what, walking to the train station for a lot of people can help.
Walking to the refrigerator.
That makes it easier. Then what do you get in the refrigerator, Rebecca? Ground turkey? Well, Scott, you also had some very interesting, speaking of food poisoning, some interesting pieces on the blog this week about another kind of poisoning.
Scorpions?
Scorpions.
in Arizona, there's a particular kind of scorpion that's common called the bark scorpion, which is actually pretty dangerous. And kids are particularly susceptible to getting stung by these scorpions. And the venom is potent and can cause some severe consequences. So the story this week is that the Food and Drug Administration approved an anti-venom that can neutralize that toxin.
And so it's mostly an issue for kids or for everybody?
Kids are at the most risk. I mean, they might be fooling around in the backyard, turning over rocks, and they're more susceptible because they're smaller. People in ill health can also be at risk.
How much is this going to cost them?
$10,000. What do you think of that?
Oof. Wow.
Yeah. So it's not cheap, but the clinical studies that were used to demonstrate that the stuff works were pretty dramatic. There was actually a study, 15 kids, half of whom got the stuff, eight actually, and seven who didn't, who got the regular treatment. And for the kids who got the anti-venom, within 4 hours, the symptoms were basically gone.
Wow.
In the group that didn't get the anti-venom, only one of them had that kind of recovery.
You said the regular treatment. Is the regular treatment a placebo or?
It's more supportive care. The neurotoxic effects make people twitchy and uncomfortable, and you have to kind of ride it out.
Is it on the market?
It was approved by the FDA this week. It has been available in Arizona hospitals, for instance, where this is the biggest issue on a what's called a compassionate use basis. So it should be broadly available and, you know, without any special restrictions any day.
Great. Well, Scott, thank you very much. Interesting as always.
You got it.
Thanks, Scott. See ya. Now we turn to a surprising consequence of our modern lifestyle. Apparently, gout is back.
Once called the disease of kings, gout used to afflict the well-to-do more than anyone else. It's a kind of arthritis that's brought on when people eat too much rich food and they don't get enough exercise.
A new study finds that now more than ever, commoners like us are suffering from this, and researchers think it's due in part to the obesity epidemic. Patty Naiman reports.
It was a sudden onset in the middle of the night. 51-year-old Greg Hanush woke up with a strange sensation in his foot, partly numb and extremely painful.
And it was so bad that I had to get my leg out from under the sheets because the pressure of the sheets on my foot and on my leg was too much.
He did manage to get back to sleep, but in the morning, the pain was worse.
I couldn't put any weight on the foot. And I was hopping around on one foot. It was almost as bad as if the foot was broken.
Hanush had a similar problem 10 years earlier. He suspected gout and called his doctor right away.
He said to get in there, which I did. He confirmed he did some blood work on me and confirmed that my uric acid levels were sky high.
And really high levels of uric acid are the main cause of gout, which was the diagnosis for Hanush. The excess uric acid had formed crystals, sort of like little needles, and migrated to joints like his feet, elbows, and shoulders, causing the intense pain and inflammation. There are a number of reasons for too much uric acid. A big one is genetics. Being male also makes you more vulnerable. So does age. The older you are, the greater the risk. But diet is also a factor, and Hanush knew his wasn't good.
I was eating a lot of red meat, and that's one of the worst things you can do for gout. I was also drinking beer. I've been drinking beer as a regular beer drinker since I was in college.
Meats and alcohol, especially beer, can drive up levels of uric acid, which is a byproduct of digesting these foods. The more you consume, the more uric acid is produced. The same is true for certain seafood like herring and scallops, as well as sugar and sugary drinks like soda. Hanush's rheumatologist, Dr. Han Choi, studies gout at Boston University School of Medicine, and he was seeing more of it. He wanted to know if nationwide gout was on the rise. He compared rates of the disease today to about 20 years ago. He found an increase of 44%.
This is a substantial increase. The number of individuals affected by gout was 6.1 million in 1988. And 1994, but now it's 8.3 million.
That's about 4% of all Americans. And when Choi analyzed the numbers more closely, he found strong links to simultaneous increases in obesity and hypertension.
Good morning. How are you today?
At Kaiser Permanente's health clinic in Portland, Oregon, internist Keith Bachman sees plenty of patients who are overweight or obese.
We know as people gain weight, their metabolism changes in lots of ways, and one of those leads to increased uric acid level, which then leads to gout.
In fact, in Choi's study published in the Journal of the American College of Rheumatology, he says obesity is clearly a factor. Now, one in five Americans has elevated levels of uric acid. Once a patient has gout, another episode is likely, says Choi. The problem is easily treated with anti-inflammatory medication, but Choi says by far the best treatment is prevention, exactly what his patient, Greg Hanush, did.
I'm going to the Red Sox game tonight, and first thing I'm going to want to do is have a beer while I watch a ball game. It's just, you know, who I am. But unfortunately, I'll be drinking water and maybe a glass of wine. And I do miss red meat. I love steaks, hamburgers, all of that kind of stuff.
But it's been worth it, says Hanush. He hasn't had a recurrence of gout for the past year and a half, and he's lost weight. Patty Niemand, NPR News.
Conversion therapy is a controversial psychotherapy that tries to help gay men and women become straight. And we must warn you, our coverage of it was pretty controversial, too. We got a lot of comments on this.
Conversion therapy is nothing new, but it's back in the news again. And that's because presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann's husband apparently does conversion therapy at his practice in Minnesota. NPR reporter Lee Spiegel has this look at the practice of conversion therapy, profiling the experiences of two men who underwent the treatment.
At age 16, Rich Weiler sat down to calculate the cost of his attraction to men and came to a grim realization. There was no escaping it. The fact that he was gay was going to cost him.
It meant probably walking away from my religion, not having the wife and children of my future that I would expect. Lots of shame and conflict with family and others. It was just devastating to contemplate.
Weiler had grown up a conservative Christian. He loved his community, he loved his faith, and while he knew that they couldn't accept him, the idea of leaving them behind was horrifying. Still, ultimately, he decided there was just no ignoring reality.
I remember distinctly looking in the mirror and saying, "You're gay, that's it. That's stop trying to deny it, stop trying to hide it. That's who you are." And at least in that moment, I looked and I felt really relieved and like, go out and enjoy it.
And so after graduating from college, Weiler moved out to L.A. He lived on the edges of the gay community there. He went to clubs, he dated men. But always in the recesses of his mind, he says, he missed his old life. He missed his friends, his family, his religion.
It just didn't feel fulfilling. It wasn't comfortable because it was unfamiliar, a very different dynamic of people that I was used to socializing with in a lot of ways. I'm not saying that it's not right for anybody, but it didn't feel right for me.
So Weiler was stuck. Half of him was a conservative Christian who thought that same-sex attraction was wrong. The other half was a gay man at odds with his faith.
I remember for years thinking, there is just no way out. I'm going to live like this in this conflict for the rest of my life.
Then in his 30s, Weiler heard of a counselor, a man who had apparently struggled with the same issue, and said that he could help. Weiler called him and started one version of conversion therapy. Together they would sit and dissect what the therapist said were the causes of Weiler's homosexuality.
My mother had been pretty domineering and controlling.
This therapist spoke to Weiler of his difficult mother, of his emotionally absent father, saying that this family dynamic had warped him. And slowly, Weiler says, through these conversations, the way that he felt about things changed.
The actual dynamic between me and the male world shifted, and my feelings for men shifted from fear and attraction to brotherhood and connection.
Today, do you feel attracted to men ever?
I really don't. There's not a sexual component to it at all.
At all?
No.
Weiler says he's now a heterosexual. And then there's the case of Peterson Toscano.
By age 17, I determined that I wasn't going to be gay, and I don't care what it takes, I'm going to find a cure.
Like Weiler, Toscano was a religious teen who discovered that he was gay and tried practically everything to change it. There were support groups and prayer groups and exorcism. Finally, after 15 years of therapies and a failed marriage, Toscano checked himself into a live-in treatment center run by a Christian group. Like Weiler, at the center, Toscano was taught to see his homosexuality as the product of family dysfunction, specifically a breach between him and his father. To narrow this breach, Toscano says, the patients were coached on how to act more masculine.
They even had a football clinic to teach us how to play football, and they taught us how to change oil in our cars.
But the main meat of this program, says Toscano, were the confessional documents required of every patient.
We had to write about every sexual encounter we had ever had. And I have literally 300 or 400 pages of just these stories that we had to write for them.
Once the stories were written, the patients were asked to select the most humiliating one. Then during a family and friends weekend, they were told to stand and read that story aloud to everyone.
They believed that by doing this, it would release our shame. But it ended up multiplying our shame and then giving it to other people so that my parents walked away with so much shame and guilt.
Toscano says that during his 2 years in this program, he did stop thinking about men. And he believed, he said, that he was making progress.
Well, I had done so much work, and so I had to believe that something was going to come out of it.
Then Toscano got out, and he says about 2 months after his treatment ended, he woke up one morning with a completely different perspective.
It was literally that. I just woke up, and my brain was clear, and I asked myself, what the hell are you doing? This is crazy. You're not changing. You're not fooling anyone.
But Toscano says, by that point, it wasn't just a matter of walking away. It took years to get over.
It took really hard work to get my brain back and to recover from the emotional and psychological damage that I had experienced under that care.
So these two men represent two sides of a debate that's been raging in psychological circles for more than a decade. One side feels that therapies which seek to make gay people straight are invariably harmful. The other, that those therapies can help gay people who are profoundly uncomfortable with their same-sex attraction. And about 2 years ago, the American Psychological Association decided to weigh in. A task force was assembled and spent a year reviewing what evidence there was. The idea was to determine whether changing sexual orientation was possible and whether therapists could ethically do the therapy. In 2009, they issued their findings. Lee Beckstead was part of the group.
We discourage psychologists from promising that sexual orientation change is possible through psychological interventions. A psychologist cannot say, we can change your sexual orientation through these type of interventions, period.
So according to the task force, there is no compelling evidence that the kind of change Rich Weiler says he experienced is possible. But more, Beckstead, in a kind of fundamental way, called into question the very goals someone like Weiler brings to therapy.
There are lots of reasons why an individual would not want to be gay, but those reasons aren't necessarily valid reasons. Clients request a lot of things based upon either lack of knowledge or ignorance or restricted understanding.
Therapists are not cosmetologists, Beckstead argues. They don't just do what people want. For example, he said, if a girl with an eating disorder came to a therapist saying that she wanted to become thinner, the therapist couldn't ethically honor her request. From his perspective, the goal of people with same-sex attraction who wish to become straight is likewise distorted at its core. This, of course, doesn't sit well with someone like Rich Weiler.
How dare they tell me that my goal is not legitimate? That is unethical.
Weiler points out that the American Psychological Association often says that one of their central ethics is client self-determination, that clients, not therapists, should decide what is right for them. And it really riles him that, for example, the APA is supportive of therapists who help transsexual or transgender clients meet their goals.
They will help a man who comes in and says, I want to be a woman. That somehow they're okay, and they'll say, great, we can help you. But I want to be attracted to women? No, that's wrong. That makes no sense whatsoever.
But Peterson Toscano feels the APA position is necessary.
The vast majority of people who try to change cannot. And the distress that's caused is real. It's not just that this doesn't work. It's destructive.
From Toscano's perspective, there might be a handful of people like Weiler who benefit from this therapy. But for every Weiler, there are dozens and dozens of gay men and women who will struggle through a process that asks them to annihilate a part of themselves. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Our final story is from musician and NPR commentator David Was. He tells the story of how the simple task of cleaning his family's pool turned into a comedy of errors.
Last summer, our perpetually confused German Shepherd, Jack, mistook the gentleman who maintained our swimming pool for some kind of dastardly enemy combatant. All of a sudden, the dog who'd happily fielded thrown tennis balls from the laid-back surfer dude mistook him for Chemical Ali. Must have been the jugs of chlorine he was carrying. Loyal Jack sank his pearly whites into the man's wrist and didn't relent until I whacked him with a broom. I drove the formerly nice man to the ER and waited several hours to make sure he was okay. 2 weeks later, he sued us, but good, and we lost our homeowner's insurance after a healthy settlement was reached. Nice doggy. Lesson learned, no more pool man. In an astonishing display of both hubris and cheapness, I decided I'd take on the task myself. The result? When summer rolled around this year, the pool was unfit for anyone but the toxic Avenger to swim in. Not to worry. Armed with YouTube do-it-yourself tutorials, I rented a pump, emptied 10,000 gallons of scummy water into the street, and started scrubbing the plaster walls. I opened up the filter and cleaned a year's worth of compacted green bio-sludge that smelled worse than the devil's outhouse. The tally thus far? I figured I'd save $200 in labor costs and knock 3 years off my life breathing lethal bacterial gases. But hold the Speedo, cowboy. Before plunging in, I had to take a sample of the fresh water down to the pool supply shop and have it analyzed. $100 later, I was swirling jugs of something called muriatic acid and chlorine into the cement pond. The follow-up test went no better. I spent another $50 on a sack of conditioner, a gallon of water clarifier, and 2 quarts of algae control. I had turned into a cold-blooded serial killer of single-celled organisms and wasted goodly amounts of time, money, and sanity. The following day, I did what I should have done in the first place. I went to Craigslist and found myself a fastidious 62-year-old Korean man, a former pro baseball player, as it turned out, who scrubbed the tile, vacuumed the leaves, and adjusted the chemicals while his wife busied herself watering the roses and tidying up the garden. For $75 a month, I'll look forward to seeing the Kim family every Wednesday at 10 a.m.
Well, that wraps it up for Your Health this week.
Thanks to our blog guru, Scott Hensley, for stopping by to chat, and thanks for intern Maureen for helping with production.
Maureen Langlois.
That's it.
You can find the blog posts.
You just like saying that.
That's right. I do. It's a lovely name. You can find the blog posts we talked about with Scott, as well as archived episodes of this podcast at npr.org/shots.
Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Well, may the scales turn, the swimmers turn, the lovers burn peace. May the generals learn when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go.